what's happening is there's an unknown level of damage and injury. They see that if the worst case occurs, they're going to have notes due on their ships. Their families are not going to have any income.
What's happening is there's an unknown level of damage and injury. They see that if the worst case occurs, they're going to have notes due on their ships. Their families are not going to have any income from the fishing industry. And they are concerned as to how that's going to happen. That, as you probably know, they've got to now equate that into a damage claim. I think what they have to do is be reassured that if the worst case scenario occurs, they're going to have a method or program that will allow them to be taken care of, in either, as the mayor suggested, lieutenant governor, some kind of low interest loan program or something like that. So we're going to have to find a way to deal with it. They're now in the worst case scenario. We understand it. Hopefully, because of the containment, because of the booming, because of some of the things, the injury to the fishing industry will not be as dramatic as the worst case scenario. But we're going to find, and the president is talking and working on this problem daily.
But just to distill what you've said, you will be forthcoming with financial aid for those people in a timely manner, whether it is required of Exxon or whether it comes directly from the U.S. government. Those people can be assured that they will be financially accounted for.
Well, we're going to come up with a program that gives them a level of assistance that we hope will be comforting. I don't want to be any more specific than that, because there are various alternatives that are being looked at, and it's not fair to prejudge any one of those. But we're not, as I said, this administration is not going to let the fishermen be in a situation where they're totally unprotected.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bosco, the gentleman from Washington State, Mr. Miller.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, I appreciate those comments you just made. As I said before you got here, many of the fishermen who have been severely economically impacted or will be, come from my district, north of Seattle, Washington, state of Washington, and are very interested in seeing that they are included in any scheme that is devised for compensation. The question I have relates to the failure of the president to declare a national disaster. And you were involved, I know, in that decision. Before you got here, the mayor said, gee, if this had happened off Long Island or off San Francisco or off Seattle, he believes there would have been a national disaster declared. And he struck a sympathetic chord with me. Now, let me get very specific here. We've been told that one of the keys to cleanup is to get the skimmers in there early. Okay. I've been told there are 14 skimmers that the Navy has down near San Francisco that could have been flown up there. But the key to getting those Navy skimmers up there early on was the declaration of a national disaster. That was the prerequisite. You know, why, in light of that, didn't the president declare a national disaster?
I think you're misinformed.
Okay,
tell
me
that you're misinformed. We've got four up there now. I mean, we've got Navy skimmers on scene right now. Nothing's changed.
You've got how many up there now?
Almost as many Air Force airplanes up there.
There's a total of 15 skimmers on scene right now, various Navy and Coast Guard skimmers. And some of them are military skimmers. I mean, I was up there. I saw the Air Force flying in resources all the time. I mean, there's almost as many Air Force airplanes up there as there is Coast Guard.
Why weren't the 14 skimmers from San Francisco flown up there immediately?
Well, first of all, we have skimmers placed strategically all over the country. You can't take every skimmer in America and bring them up to Alaska and then have another catastrophe. Number two, the skimming, and this is important. The first few hours are the crucial hours. Skimmers work best, if I might add, maximum 500 gallons an hour, when they've got a heavy concentration close to the ship, contained by booms, in the first hours. When you start skimming,
hundreds of square miles of water with what they call moosed oil, you have a completely different skimming problem. And the best way to contain that is not by trying to skim all over the ocean, but to boom and protect the fishing areas, at the same time skimming where you can. But there's a
are you saying that there were skimmers on the scene within 24 hours? There were sufficient number of skimmers?
No, I'm not saying that. I didn't say that. There's no question there wasn't. I said this earlier. There's no question that the response was totally inadequate. I said that. It's clear when you go up there. In fact, the response didn't really get coordinated until Monday evening. That's when the governor said it was no longer necessary for a federalization of the effort. We agreed with him. So,
Secretary, I understand the White House is now calling for you. We have three additional people here who have not had a chance to ask any questions. Would you and the governor consent perhaps to give them each one question, if you don't mind?
Sure.
Starting with Ms.
President, what I do.
Ms. Unsel from Washington State.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, I was delighted to hear your favorable comments on Chairman Jones' House Resolution 1465, and it may be even better legislation than you had in mind, because it does have the provision to compensate for those who have relied on the natural resource that may be harmed in excess of 25%. They have the ability to be able to tap that fund. That wouldn't be taxpayer money. It would be a fund created by the oil industry, in exchange for which they are asking for a uniform standard of liability. And perhaps we can cooperatively work on that, and it may also be able to be applied retroactively so that it could apply to this spill. I hope the Secretary will entertain our working on this together. And I would like to ask about safety measures we need to have redundant. We hope we never have to use them. What would how would you view an additional safety feature that tugs be required to accompany these vessels during the movement through these particular waters? Because it seems to me that allows an extra set of eyes, an extra set of brains to keep track of what is going on when you have failure in the pilot house. How would you do that?
I think I'd ask the experts in navigation and safety to take a look at it, and if they think that makes sense, we'll do it. I don't pretend to be an expert on pilotage except if it's in the air.
Mr. Miller,
I'm an expert there.
Briefly.
Mr. Secretary, I know you mentioned that negligence played a major role in this, but I was just wondering, and again, maybe you can't answer it, but would there be any kind of navigation aid or electronic devices? I know radar was mentioned in the Port of Valdez that would detect or warn the vessel or the people in charge of the vessel, even though they may be acting on their own in a negligent fashion. I mean, it's some way, a kind of an extra precaution, either through navigation aids or electronic device, that goes beyond the negligence of the vessel crew.
Well, there's a couple of side-looking radars and a couple of things, but in this situation, it's pretty hard to have a device on a ship that protects someone. Protects the ship when the mate or whoever's in charge deviates and goes right into a reef in an open water at 15 knots. I mean, that's, you know, we protect them for slight deviations, not a major deviation there. But we're going to look at the whole thing. I mean, tugs might help. More positive radar control might help in that area. It's pretty hard to figure out. You know, we've had some 6,000 or 7,000 tankers go up and down the Sound without any incident other than about a 5,000-gallon spill. As we know, so it can be done in normal circumstances unless there's gross negligence.
As you said to the gentleman from Washington, Mr. Hertel, have you a question? Something similar.
Could I ask you, Mr. Secretary, I want to really ask for your recommendations.
Where we should start working,
as we know, what many said could never happen has been such a great tragedy, and as you said to the gentleman from Washington, it could happen someplace else, something similar. Could I ask you, not for specific recommendations, but where we should start working in the Congress regarding the change in laws that you mentioned during your testimony that must be done? For instance, should we look at the fact that volunteers were denied in the first few days to participate in the cleanup? Maybe a little bit more extensively what you were talking about in regard to liability equipment? What really do we need to be adequate, not only in Alaska but around the country? Personnel to supervise and investigate on a regular basis, and further regulations, possibly as far as the pilots being on board for a longer time in difficult areas, et cetera. Could you just elaborate, Mr. Secretary?
Well, I think that the step that the President has taken to ask the National Response Team to evaluate the contingency plans, not only here in other parts of the country, and make sure that they are really effective is a first step. That report is due sooner. He asked for it to be sooner rather than later. I can say on a personal note that there's no one that would like to have people involved in Alaska volunteers more than the President. He came up with some suggestions when I met with him. He firmly believes that and understands the feeling that people have for the environment, and to participate in it is a good feeling. The problem is, as I indicated, is not a lack of desire. It's logistical problems in supporting a volunteer workforce of Alaskans or non-Alaskans. There's 1,000 people between military and civilian people up there now working. That's 25% of the population of Valdez. And there's more coming in every day. So the logistical support in that area of thousands of people for an effort that probably is going to take months and probably isn't even ready to begin in some areas for a little longer, you know, the will's there. We got to find the way. I know the President is totally committed to finding the way. On the other hand, we've got to deal with the immediate problem as well. So that's, you know, that's the sentiment. I think we're going to have to look for ways, and I would think in the contingency plans, we'd probably look at ways we can use volunteer help and possibly other governmental help.
Thank you, Mr. Hotel.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for taking
thank
the time.
Thank you very much,
I understand how difficult these times are, and we will be glad to talk to the President about why you're late. Also, Governor and Mayor, we want to thank you. I understand you also have an appointment, and I think you've heard some words of assurance here that we're going to follow up on and watch for you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just leave with one little note, because of the nature of the questions that have been asked, I think it's important. We hear over and over that this was inevitable. This spill was not inevitable. The state-of-the-art equipment that is there and is in place, this is a brand new tanker. It's been in service for barely 2 years. It certainly was no more inevitable than the bombing of some airplane. It was absolute stupidity and pure negligence. The systems are there and in place. The rules have to be followed. The contingency plans are there, but again, the rules have to be followed, and I think that's the important thing, that there was some gross violations of the rules at every turn in this matter.
Mr. Chairman, I gather that this is about over, and if you'd indulge me for just 1 minute, I'd like to make
a
statement.
Let me assure you it's not over. We're going to take a recess for about, we're not going to recess for about 45 minutes to 1 o'clock. At which time, I want to warn you all, we're going to have the chairman of Exxon, Mr. L.G. Roll, here to testify, and that should be an interesting session. So I want to kind of plug it and ask you to rejoin us at 1 o'clock. But go ahead, Mayor, with your statement.
Well, if I could just make one very short statement. I'm a part-time mayor from a very small Alaskan community. I'm not happy with the hand I've been dealt here at all. I was quite comfortable before all of this happened. I probably made quite a bit of the oil industry angry at me because I've been kind of verbal about what has taken place up there. I don't mean to make the President of the United States mad at me. However, for some reason, I'm leaving here not totally convinced that there is a real plan that's going to take care of the victims of this problem. And that bothers me greatly. The cleanup has a blank check. Why don't the victims have something? We're not asking to let Exxon off on this. What we're asking for is there's got to be done, something's got to be done to keep from forcing not just the fishermen. The fishermen are going to be hurt, but the processors, the people that are involved in tourism, the support industries that are there, there's got to be done something to support these people. Low interest loans until they can settle with Exxon. Don't force these people into making an early settlement with Exxon so that they don't lose their boats or lose their businesses. And that's what we're asking for. And I appreciate it. A number of you have made very strong comments to this, and I appreciate that very much. But I'm going home not totally convinced
that there truly is a plan to take care of these people.
Mr.
And I think that's a shame.
Just so you'll know, there is indeed federal authority for disaster declarations and assistance. I live on the Gulf Coast in Louisiana. We're often hit by hurricanes. And while it's not by damage done by drunken sailors, it's nevertheless severe damage. And the people of my district are fishermen, like the people of your district, and they end up having to make the same request often of government. We're in the process of looking now at declarations of disaster for some natural cause disasters in that area. Be assured that the processes are there. What you've heard today is some words of assurance from the Secretary of Transportation that he intends to see to it that those processes are utilized. We're going to watch that for you. We're going to see to it, in fact, that those processes are, in fact, followed. For the people in your district. Mr. Bateman wanted to make a comment before recess.
I've been sitting here concerned about whether or not legalistically there is a problem that this is not a natural disaster. And the normal mechanisms whereby the governor requests and the president declares an area to be a disaster area give you the kind of opportunity for assistance you need. I think we need to have an answer from our staff, anyone else who's got an answer, as to whether or not you fit the situation where routinely and commonly areas are defined or identified as being disaster areas, triggering the low-interest loan, Small Business Administration assistance, and other assistance. For my part, I hope that you are, and if you are, I don't see any reason why that should not be done immediately, notwithstanding what Exxon might do and should do, being to the very maximum extent forthcoming. So I think we need an answer as to what the federal government can do and whether or not the fact that this is not a natural disaster is an impediment to things being done that we'd like to have done.
That is a good point. I want to point out, however, that even where the clear case of natural disaster occurs, that there is a process by which damages must be defined as to have occurred over a certain amount before those things are triggered. So that while those questions must be answered and you legitimately raise them, the process does require evaluation of the damages as they occur, and that prospective restitution is not provided in the law. So we're going to have to work these things out with you and your folks, and just be aware that we're here and we're ready to assist you in working those problems out. Gentlemen, thank you again for your appearance. The subcommittee will be in recess until 1 o'clock when we'll have Mr. Rawl, chairman of Exxon, here to testify. The subcommittee is now in recess. The subcommittee will please again come to order.
Session with his testimony. Before we begin, however,
as we left the hearing, I'd announced that we would have the chairman of Exxon Corporation here, Mr. L. G. Rawl, is now present, and we will begin this afternoon session with his testimony. Before we begin, however, I've received a number of requests to both members and individuals who wanted to make some submissions to the record, and let me remind you that the record will remain open for written statements or submissions under our rules for 45 days. So that any of you who have not been accorded a chance to testify or any member that wants to make a formal statement for the record, I would encourage you to do so. The better record we have, the more complete, and the better we'll be able to recommend to the full committee action on some of the issues we've been discussing today. Mr. Rawl, let me welcome you, and let me begin by telling you, sir, that I know it is not a pleasant time for you or the corporation, that we haven't called you here to beat upon you. We've called you here to learn both what happened and how we can work not only to prevent it, but hopefully to resolve problems in cleanup and mitigation and to quickly get this behind us, that we can make transportation of chemicals and other hazardous cargoes more safe, not only for the environment, but for the populace in the areas where those cargoes pass. I live in, as I pointed out, near New Orleans, and we have a great deal of hazardous cargo up and down the river.
And so the issues we examine here are much broader than one spill, even the size of this awful tragedy in Alaska. We welcome you, and we welcome your testimony,
Mr. Chairman, thank you for inviting me to come. I'll just make a short statement, and principally here to take your questions.
We do appreciate that. Your full written statement will be a part of the record.
Thank you. I'm here today to provide a frank response to questions regarding the Exxon Valdez oil spill and describe our efforts to deal with its consequences. Before this, however, I want to repeat some feelings I have, and I speak not only for myself but also for the thousands of Exxon employees who share my distress as to how sorry we are about this disaster in Alaska. We are especially sympathetic to the impacts on the residents of the Prince William Sound area and the people of the state of Alaska. Exxon takes full responsibility and has done so from the very beginning. And Exxon will continue to do all we can to clean up and mitigate the spill's effects. All necessary resources are being employed. The spill of an estimated 240,000 barrels occurred early on March 24. We have certain other factual information. The weather was clear. The ship had no known mechanical problems. A course change had been requested and authorized because of ice in the outbound shipping lane. The captain subsequently left the bridge, and tests made sometime after the grounding showed the captain's alcohol level was above limits established by the Coast Guard. Obviously, this leaves many other unanswered questions. Exxon is conducting a number of investigations of this accident, as are the National Transportation Safety Board and the Coast Guard. Other federal and state investigations are also underway. The oil spill contingency plan was activated immediately. It called for a two-phase response. The first phase was the responsibility of Alyeska, the pipeline company. The second phase was our responsibility, and our response was immediate. We immediately established the priorities, preventing additional spills from the damaged tanker and mitigating the impact of the spill on the environment and the people of Alaska. A major mobilization began immediately and by now involves dozens of vessels, airplanes, booms and skimming and other equipment. Currently, hundreds of people involved receiving support and direction from over 200 Exxon experts and consultants and a number of government agency people. We also mobilized to mitigate the economic impact on the communities of Prince William Sound. A claims office staffed by 30 people has been opened and adequate funds are placed in accounts in local banks. These funds are available to provide immediate advance payments to those requiring monetary support while claims are being prepared, reviewed, and processed. Our intention is to provide fair, reasonable, and prompt settlements.
Yesterday, as I'm sure you know,
as of noon on Tuesday, approximately 97% of the 1 million barrels of crude oil remaining upon the Exxon Valdez was successfully removed. Yesterday, as I'm sure you know, the vessel was floated off the reef and has been removed to a temporary anchorage where temporary repairs are being made.
We cannot judge how
and then, of course, after that, we'll move it to a yard to have permanent repairs made. For now, it is too early to assess long-term environmental impact. Natural resource damage assessment studies are underway. We cannot judge how long recovery will take in Prince William Sound, but I can assure you that since March 24, the accident has been receiving our full attention and will continue to do so until the job is done. We are continuing to cooperate fully to establish the facts as to what happened. More importantly, however, we want to help in any way we can to establish what might be done to reduce the chances of such an accident happening again. I can assure you that actions are already underway within Exxon to revise policies and procedures in the light of this accident.
Extraordinarily difficult to understand.
Thank you, Mr. Rolfe.
I suppose everyone in the most obvious question that arises is one that's at first complimentary of your corporation and at the same time extraordinarily difficult to understand, and that is that everyone in the industry that I speak to tells me that Exxon, among all the corporations that transport major quantities of crude oil, has one of the best programs.
occurred.
To insure against this type of an accident.
Can't explain why.
And yet it happened.
We have had some time an alcohol policy.
Well, we're talking about the human error, obviously, that occurred. Can't explain why, except that we have had for some time an alcohol policy that permitted people who would volunteer that they had a problem, which of course is obviously good to encourage people to do that. We and our medical program would pay for rehabilitation, and then subsequently we would keep them on the payroll. Now, unfortunately, it was not clear enough that when someone had a job, that a high-risk job, whether we're talking about an officer on a ship, or, for example, in your state, a control man in a large refinery, or other very sensitive jobs, airplane pilot or helicopter pilot, judgment had to be made at the level as to the operating level as to who had those jobs and how, if in fact they had indicated an alcohol problem or more recent times a drug problem and they were rehabilitated, obviously someone had to make the judgment that they shouldn't be put back in that kind of a job. So it was a slip up in this regard. Now we've heard about having lost his license, DWI and so forth. Some of those things have come to light. We were not aware of those things.
Never heard of the man until.
Are you saying that the company was aware that he had an alcohol problem at one time and that he had been rehabilitated in your eyes?
Well,
consistent with that policy,
we were aware he had an alcohol problem. I personally never heard of the man until, of course, Good Friday. But he had an alcohol problem. He had turned himself in, as I understand it, Mr. Chairman. And that, consistent with that policy, they arranged for rehabilitation. He entered a program. He was followed up, watched, and so forth. But even that's inadequate if someone, as we all know, the statistics pretty well prove you have a problem like that, you have to be helped, and you have to, for humane and human reasons, be helped, and you have to, but you need close follow-up. But even with close follow-up, there are certain things you can't have people do, in my view. Needless to say, we now have a policy that we had to get down. Normally, you don't want to write a policy that has listed exceptions, but we're in that mode at the present time.
It's been said that a larger crew might have prevented the spill. Was this ship, the Exxon Valdez, properly crewed?
Yes, sir, it was properly crewed. I've heard that, but that's absolutely not correct.
Well, from time to time,
would it have helped had you had a policy on board the ship for some sort of reporting of alcohol abuse by other members of the crew?
Well, from time to time, we operate a fleet worldwide. We also charter a lot of ships, but we have 71 tankers hauling a variety of cargoes, and from time to time someone will say that,
to my knowledge,
not necessarily the master, but someone has a drinking problem.
Yes.
And you'll follow up on it, and some amount of time there's some fire under that smoke. In this case, we had no reports, to my knowledge.
Mr. Rowley, this cleanup will cost your corporation, we're told, at least $100 million before it's finished. And
more than that.
We're also told that it will probably exceed that by a large amount. Now, the vessel, I'm told, is worth about $27 million or so.
No.
Well, I'd like to correct that. That vessel cost $125 million 3 years ago, 2.5, 3 years ago.
So that it is. Okay. So that the vessel itself is, in your opinion, worth more than the cleanup will cost?
No. If I could just write off the vessel right now and have everything cleaned up there, I'd do that in an instant. Let me tell you. No, this is cleanup. It's going to be very expensive. I can't tell you how much because I don't know what damage ultimately we have to clean.
Well, you know, the question has been asked, and let me make it public. With good weather to contain the spill by booming the ship, with
so large a spill and its consequences so readily available to anyone who wanted to take a picture of it. Was the decision, was the option ever examined to simply boom and burn?
The ship?
The oil, the ship, the entire mess?
I don't think that option. The plan, there is a contingency plan on the books.
Then in the early 80s,
part of it, well, it was part of the Alaska pipeline
part of it,
trade and legislation and so forth. That contingency plan had originally been in place as sort of an Alyeska contingency plan. Then in the early 80s, the pipeline had a certain part of it, and the shippers, whether that be Exxon or someone else, or someone that might buy crude at Valdez and charter a ship and take it out. The shippers then had responsibility for certain kinds of spills. Now, in this case, it has been recognized for a long time, both in this country and in this contingency plan and around the world, that when you have a large spill, too large for rapid booming just around the ship, which you're talking about large spills, but much smaller than this one, that one important part of that plan is immediately mobilize both aerial equipment, water equipment, and dispersants to mitigate some of the impact of this spill.
Yes.
And that was part of the plan that had been reviewed by the state environmental people, I presume, a number of times. I've not personally been involved in that negotiation, but also reviewed by the Coast Guard, and quite sure that the EPA is aware of this situation, or certainly even reviewed it. Now, the problem we got into was the Alyeska responsibility, according to these rather complex plans, was that they had the initial response requirement through phase one, so to speak, and the intent there was that within about 5 hours at this distance to get to the ship, boom the ship, and contain the spill. And there was a delay because the barges, the barge they were going to use actually had, as you probably have read, had some difficulty and was in a condition where they couldn't use it at that time. They in fact got down there, as I read it, and I see a whole lot of different things and all this stuff, in 10 hours, let's say. But had they gotten there in 5, it would have been very difficult to contain such a spill. Then phase two was our responsibility. We were supposed to mobilize equipment and material as rapidly as possible, which we feel like we did. And then two ways to handle this, and you brought this up when you talked about the burning. You could burn the crude without burning the ship, obviously. We did it, and that's been used in a lot of places. This crude would burn. We tried, actually, we wanted, as part of this plan, we wanted to go ahead and start spraying a detergent, and we wanted to test burn. We could not get authority on Saturday when we were prepared. We had a C-130 aircraft.
Where did you need authority?
We needed authority. It's described in this plan that down to a certain point, certain zones, well, the Coast Guard officer in charge on the location has authority, but this particular ship, and part of the spill was in such an area that, as I understand it, I'm getting in an area where there's still a lot of interviewing going on, he had to get approval from, or at least agreement out of the state environmental people. But then the discussion started as to, you know, we're not sure you can use that detergent, or the wind's not right, or you're going to kill fish or something. The facts are this detergent is approved. It's not really detergent. It's a dispersant which has detergent qualities. This material is approved for use in the state of California, which is pretty meticulous about things like this.
Well, let me sure see if I understand what you're telling us. What you're saying is that when it came to some of these early decisions, actually to either burn the oil or to put detergent disbursements on the oil, that you had difficulty obtaining state authority to do it?
Well, I'm not sure whose authority. I think it has to be a joint thing. We had requested such, actually applied for the request on Friday, although we were not ready with the equipment on Friday. Saturday morning, we renewed it, and this is a coordinated effort. Well, I'm not really trying to blame anybody because a lot of confusion. It was our spill, but there was a delay there. We finally got authority to test the material, which we had tested many times. We used it in the Mexican spill, you recall, the X-Stock well and so forth. A lot of this material was used and it worked. It's essentially non-toxic to, in the proper applications to marine life or certainly fish. Now, it's certainly a lot more, or a lot less toxic than that crude oil laying out there. And when you disperse it, it doesn't sink to the bottom. It stays in the upper levels of the water column, which permits it to biodegrade more rapidly and so forth. Now, I don't mean that we could have just sprayed this stuff and like magic 200,000 barrels would disappear, but we would have greatly mitigated that damage. We were then told that we finally got approval to do this. I'm talking about from Saturday morning, we were ready. We asked for it on Friday. We asked again Saturday. Had several conversations. We finally got approval at 6:45 on Sunday. And the weather turned pretty bad on us, as you know. The 70-mile gust blew the roof off the off a hangar at the Valdez Airport. We ended up, we couldn't fly on Monday. And then we got back to it Monday afternoon. I'm not saying that we still didn't have a very bad problem. We still would have had considerable damage, but we would have greatly mitigated
it. Mr. Rawl, I think it will help us a great deal, and you don't have to do it here today orally. Perhaps a letter submission to the committee would be helpful. But to have a timetable analysis of how decisions were approached in those first 3 days, when there was good weather, and when response mechanisms may in fact have yielded some good early results before the bad weather did set in. I think it would be useful for us to know what were the problems in getting authority or approval or making decisions, because that essentially is what our committee will be looking at when it comes to those contingency plans and providing for future incidents, God forbid they should occur again. And so if you can prepare for us perhaps a chronology of those first 3 days, and the decisions that were made or not made, and why not, regarding authorities that could not be obtained, we would greatly appreciate that kind of a submission.
I'll be glad to do so. I've got one.
My own time is expired. I want to give other members a chance, but I want to ask you one really tough question that's got to be asked. I represent a state that has been extraordinarily supportive of the oil and gas industry. And so when I heard the Mayor Valdez and the Lieutenant Governor today speak about their community's sense of betrayal, it really rang home. Folks I represent want to and have encouraged oil and gas exploration, development, transportation, the whole range of refining and distribution and sales in a way that few areas of the country have permitted, accepted, and encouraged. And I suppose they're watching and listening too today. And they've heard that statement from the mayor and the governor, lieutenant governor, of that sense of betrayal. Have they been betrayed, and what's your answer to it? What do you intend to do to, again, reestablish your credibility and your support base among the people of Valdez and Alaska who have been so supportive, as we have, of your industry?
Well, I appreciate your state being in that condition, Mr. Chairman, and I regret very much. Of course, I didn't hear the testimony of these gentlemen from Alaska.
I think I've summarized it.
I think you probably have. And
one word, betrayed.
They're sure very angry. Certainly, we don't feel obviously, betrayal wouldn't be a word. It was a tragic accident. Shouldn't have happened. We're going to clean up the damage. We've said that. We're responsible for people's, if they lost their fishing season or two seasons or whatever it is or whatever we have to do, we've accepted responsibility for that. We are using a large number of these people now on the ground and on boats. And we've got a large number of local people employed. We'll have to employ more. And we can, once, now that we've got this ship out of our hair, so to speak, and if we can get that repaired and out of there, we can, and we've been moving forward on all fronts on this thing, but we can focus, and plus a lot of the oil has moved down the sound, and some of it's out in the Gulf of Alaska, as I'm sure you've heard. We've boomed the fisheries, or we've had a lot of help in these regards, but we've got a lot of equipment, a lot of people. We're willing to apply whatever we can, but as you've been told, this is not a very easy area in which to work, but we're getting on with it, and I would hope to, as promptly as possible, both from the standpoint of the citizens of your state, certainly the state of Alaska and every place else, mitigate this thing and hopefully get it in shape to where it could turn it around to at least be successful in undoing the damage we did as promptly as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Rawls. Gentleman from Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rawls, what's Exxon doing for the fishermen in the Prince William Sound? I know you've addressed this already, but we want it for the record. And particularly those in Cordova. Cordova is a highly concentrated area that fishes the sound very, very, very heavily, and they have tremendous concern. And for the record, what's Exxon doing?
Well, what we've been trying to do, as I mentioned in my opening statement, Congressman, is that we've got claims office open. People that are suffering cash shortages as a result of this, and I understand there's been some loss in herring fishing and so forth, can come in and get, and by the way, I've mentioned to our people that we want rapid processing. We don't want a bureaucratic processing of claims, but we have money in Alaskan banks, and we're willing to give them bridging money, and we'll process these claims as promptly as possible. Also, we want to put these people to work. I think we've put quite a few of these people to work, and we'll put more to work, but of course you're from there, you know what I'm talking about when we talk about the risk. The only good thing in this whole thing so far is no one was killed and no one was badly hurt, but we have, when you have 1,000 people out there and you have 15-foot tides, which are unknown in this part of the U.S., and rocky cliffs, and it's pretty risky stuff. So a lot of our employees have volunteered, and we're using experts and so forth. But our problem is compounded by the location, the vast distances, and so forth.
We're aware of that. I'm trying to, again, these would be a series of questions pertaining to the same thing. What is your plan to set up a long-term environmental monitoring program to determine the long-term effects? My biggest concern, Mr. Rawls, and I know you made this statement, you're going to take care of the problem. I also am one as a realist. Once this disappears from the Washington Post front pages, which is already beginning to decline, and the New York Times and all the rest of these beautiful pieces of broadcasting instruments that we use, you're going to have a legal force of about probably around 25,000 lawyers worldwide. And some of them say, you don't have to do that. Let's go to court. My people can't afford to go to court. I don't want them to go to court. And I can assure you, if I'm having the same, but they're not going to go to court, we're going to have a fair deal out. So what is your plan for the long range?
I don't want them to go to court either.
That's right.
And now the long range, in terms, well, you're talking both environment and liability, I suppose. But in terms of the environment, we're having studies made. We've got baseline studies. We've got a lot of environmental experts that don't work for us. So it's, you know, independent experts, so to speak, academics doing studies, and there'll be more of that. In terms of the damage to the fisheries that your people, as you put it, use in that sound or wherever this oil may show up, we're just going to deal with that as we see it. I mean, I can't project, and I hope it goes away more rapidly than one might expect. As you know, worldwide, it's a mixed bag as to how long the damage lasts and how short it lasts. So we're going to take care of the people in Alaska.
Now, we understand that. Now, I'll give you a case in point. 4 years down the road, no environmental damage is evident. This is a hypothetical question. The fish have returned. Hopefully they will return much sooner. The fish have returned. And the main market for our fish, frankly, is some in Washington State, although not that much, but Japan, the Asian market. And the buyer's going to say, they're from Prince William Sound, and your fish is worth 25 cents a pound instead of 270 in another area. What's going to be Exxon's response to that?
Well, we're just going to have to see the situation, Congressman. I just can't speculate on a hypothetical response to a hypothetical question. I understand what you're saying, but when you get into things like remote damages and so forth, it'll be, if they're valid claims, they'll be paid. I would hope that if there was any difference in the price, it's certainly as big as that. But I think,
to give you an example, if I may, for instance, one of the reasons the herring fisheries was closed this time is not only to protect the stocks, but we have been informed that the price of herring had been 1/10 of 100% of what it was last year, although it may not have been contaminated. And we have no control over that.
It's a reputation problem.
That's right. It's a reputation.
And that's my problem, too, right now, frankly.
True.
And I'm going to try to understand your problem, and hopefully you understand mine, and we're going to do everything we can to reconcile that problem.
Okay, now, last question. There's been a lot of suggestions. You know, I believe you were on the other side of the aisle today, and the question of you know, short-term loans and declaring an emergency or disaster area, which we have asked them to declare an emergency. We may have difficulty declaring it a disaster area. And we're talking about the side effect of loss of revenue. Now, we can immediately try to take, and you said you would, the fisherman direct impact, the loss of a herring season, the loss of salmon run, the lower prices, the problem with the Cordova fish in this area. But what happens to the contractor that has three houses under contract now, but the contracts were broken because the fisherman figures he will not get his money on time to pay back or pay the contractor's fees. Now, is there any way you can set up a fund where you, in fact, could lend money under that premises to keep these people afloat?
We'll just have to look at that, Congressman. You, as you understand, I just, you know, have other people that are dealing with this problem, and I'm not talking legally with you now. I'm not talking about talking to the lawyer as to how can we avoid this, because we're not going to avoid that. But valid claims will be settled or paid.
Go back to my other statement. We're going to monitor this very close. And as you mentioned, your reputation is on the block, as well as the oil industries and the state of Alaska.
I'm aware of that.
And I hope we can all work together. What I do not want, and I say this with respect to everyone in the audience and on this committee who have gone to Harvard Law School, lawyers make money out of confrontation, not with negotiations. And what I don't want is that large battery of Exxon lawyers saying you don't have to do this. This is 2 years after the fact, and I got fishermen hurt, and I've got a lot of people hurting, and they can't afford to hire an attorney.